normally used for Little League games, because it could be locked. If I move it myself, Claire said, I'll break it. I'm so nervous about Saturday, I'm shaking.
You have no reason to be nervous, Locke said.
And yes, he said, he would come help her. Ted Trimble's shop was unoccupied when Claire pulled in. A note on the door read, Claire, it's upstairs. Claire walked up the hot stairs into a cavernous room filled with light fixtures and wires and extension cords and bulbs and stove burners and sections of slant fin radiator. There were two desks in the center of the room, back to back, one for Ted's secretary, Bridget, and one for his wife, Amy, who did the bookkeeping, but neither Bridget nor Amy was around. The fans were running and the radio was on. It was murderously hot. Claire hadn't had time to get lunch, and the climb up the stairs made her dizzy. She heard Locke call up from the bottom of the stairs. Hello? I'm up here, she said. She did not see the chandelier. She heard Locke reach the top of the stairs, and she said, I can't find it.
It's right here, he said.
She turned as he lifted the chandelier from a white box. Locke held the chandelier from the top, where Ted had affixed a silver chain. At the end of the chain was an inverted sterling silver bowl that held the wires. The chandelier dangled from Locke's hands. It twirled, even in the still heat of the room. God, Claire said.
It's gorgeous, Locke said.
He traced the arc of one of the chandelier's arms with his finger.
It is absolutely gorgeous.
Claire knew what the chandelier looked like. She had its shape and form memorized. She had spent more time with this piece than with any other piece in her career. And yet, when Locke held it, when she gazed at it from afar, it was like seeing it for the first time. That deep, luscious pink, those twisting, draping arms, it was glorious, it was graceful. It was, as far as glass went, a work of genius. Claire felt her eyes burning with tears. She was thinking of all the hours that had gone into the creation of that goddamn chandelier. The effort, the energy, the hours that she could have spent, should have spent, doing other things, tending to her children, her marriage, her life. The chandelier was the opposite of where she had failed. It was where she had succeeded. And in 2 days, she would sell it to the highest bidder. I don't know if I can let it go, she said. I don't know if I can part with it.
It will be in safe hands, Locke said softly. It will be in my hands. I will pay whatever I have to in order to get it.
This sounded like one of the nicest things anyone had ever said to Claire. The words were meant to comfort and to compliment. Claire thought back to the first auction meeting, when Locke began his campaign to get her back to work. It had been an idea then, and now it was a resplendent reality, dangling from Locke's hands. Just as their attraction to each other that first night had been a tiny seedling of thought, of curiosity. And now what was it? It was as complicated and as fragile as the chandelier. What was left unspoken, of course, was that the chandelier would hang in the house that Locke shared with Daphne. It would grace the meals they ate together. It would never hang in the house that Locke owned with Claire. Locke would never own a house with Claire. They would never be together. This, suddenly, was as obvious and oppressive as the heat in the room. Even though Locke would most likely buy the chandelier, Claire would never see it again. I have to get out of here, she said. This heat is making me dizzy.
Right, Locke said. I'll help you get this to the rec fields.
They tucked the chandelier back into the box and padded it with bubble wrap. They closed the box and sealed it with electrical tape.
It was safe.
Locke carried it down the stairs with Claire following behind on unsteady feet. Locke set the box in the back of Claire's Honda Pilot. Claire said, Would you drive? Sure. He took her car keys, got behind the wheel of her car, adjusted the seat. They were alone in her car on legitimate gala business. Every other time they had been alone in her car, it had been illegitimate business, the business of their love affair, and this thought made it too awkward to speak. Even though Claire had things she wanted to tell Locke, about Isabel's adamant silence, about her own anger over what had happened with the catering, Claire couldn't speak, but she wanted him to speak. She had fallen in love with him, the silver belt buckle, and the bald spot, and his deep reservoir of kindness and generosity, and the new idea of herself that he had given her. The Viognier, the Bose radio, the gardens at greater light, kissing him on the chilly cement steps, she had felt like a teenager again, like a person, a woman desirable to him and to herself. It was not tawdry or careless, it was real. She wanted a life where she could reach out and straighten his tie, where they could share a sandwich, where they could stand in line together at the post office, his chin resting on her head. The worst thing about adultery, their kind anyway, was that that life was never going to happen. And it was so, so sad. She stared at him, his cheek, his ear, the creases at the corners of his eyes. She knew every inch of him intimately, but he said nothing. Nothing. The silence was oppressive. If Claire opened her mouth, she knew what would come out. This is pointless. We have no future. We'll never be together, not properly. Continuing is emotional suicide. What are we doing? How can it possibly be worth it? We have to stop. We should never have started. Locke pulled into the parking lot of the rec fields. The tent was up now, a white elephant, a spaceship. Locke cleared his throat.
It was nice to see you.
At 8:30 the next morning, there was no sign of Pan, and Claire, because she was busy cleaning up breakfast and deciding how to attack the problem of Isabel, should she apologize for the Nan Mag article even though she didn't write it, let the kids run around outside in their pajamas. Claire knocked tentatively on Pan's door. This was highly unusual. Claire couldn't remember another time when Pan had been even 5 minutes late. It simply never happened. There was a groan from inside, which Claire took as a cue to open the door. Pan lay in bed with her hair in her face. The room was stuffy. Pan never opened her windows because she found even summer nights too cold. "Are you okay?" Claire said. In her mind, she launched automatically into a Hail Mary. Not 2 days before the gala, not today, when Claire had a list a mile long, not tomorrow, when Matthew was coming, and certainly not Saturday, when Claire would be unavailable from start to finish. Pan groaned. Claire approached the bed. There was a half-eaten bowl of rice on the dresser. "Pan? Are you sick?" Pan pushed her hair out of her face.
"I feel hot," she said.
Claire gasped. Pan was covered with red spots. On the way home from the doctor, with Pan leaning limply against the car door, Tylenol, the doctor had said, baths with baking soda, bed rest, Claire called Isabel at home. No one answered, so Claire left a message on the machine. "Hey, Isabel, it's Claire. Listen, will you call me when you get this message, please? It seems odd I haven't heard from you this week, and I just want to make sure we're all set with the event." Pause. Mention the elephant in the room. "I know you were upset about the magazine article, and honestly, no one was more shocked that you weren't mentioned than I was. It's awful. An egregious oversight. I'll say something to Tessa." "Okay, call me, please." Claire hung up, then dialed Isabel's cell phone. Again, no answer. Again, Claire left a message. "Hey, Isabel, it's Claire." She paused, thinking, "I find your behavior discouraging and immature. Call me when you get a chance." On Thursday, when Locke walked into the office, he stopped first at Gavin's desk. Slowly, Gavin raised his eyes from his work. Locke said,
"Is it true that you're going to the gala with Isabel?"
"Yes."
Daphne told me that, but I didn't quite believe it. Isabel invited you?
I didn't invite myself.
Of course not. Well, good. I'm glad you're going with Isabel. You've worked hard, and you deserve it.
I'm sure it seems odd to you.
Not odd at all, Locke said. Have you decided what you're wearing on Saturday?
Gavin said, Navy blazer, white shirt, mattress pants, loafers.
Tie, Locke said.
No, Gavin said, but you should wear one, as the director. Locke nodded and moved on to his desk.
Gavin let his breath go. The most crucial thing, he decided last night, was to get the money out of his car and into the bank, into the Nantucket's Children Operating Fund. If it was in the fund, no one could accuse him of stealing it. But Gavin couldn't just show up with $52,000 to deposit, could he? Claire had said she would come at 2 o'clock to help, but she didn't show up until 4, at which point Siobhan was at the end of her rope. Claire said, Sorry I'm so late. You're not going to believe what happened. Did the woman think she was the only person with problems? Did she think she was the only person who was insanely busy? One thing was for certain. Since she'd decided to co-chair the gala, Claire had cornered the market on drama. Siobhan said nothing, and Claire stood there expectantly, waiting for Siobhan to bite. Siobhan would not bite. Siobhan was tired of the way things worked in this friendship, with Claire's problems constantly taking top billing. She would not ask. She was in the middle of poaching 600 lobsters, a hot and thankless fucking job. You had to rip the claws off the poor buggers before you dropped them in, otherwise the whole mess tasted like rubber bands. Siobhan would make Claire rip the claws off. Just thinking this made Siobhan smile, which Claire took as her cue to proceed. Isabel isn't speaking to me because of that stupid article in Nanmag. Siobhan didn't know how angry at Claire she really was until she decided, in that split second, to take Isabel French's side. Well, she wasn't mentioned at all, not once.
I know, Claire said, but that's not my fault. How can she blame me?
Siobhan didn't answer. She held up a lobster. There was a tub of them, crawling all over one another, on the floor. They were really quite unappetizing-looking creatures.
Here, she said. Rip the claws off. Remove the rubber bands. Throw it into the pot.
Claire made a face.
I can't do that. You came to help, Siobhan said. This is what I need done. What about making the gazpacho?
I finished that an hour ago, Siobhan said. If you'd been here at 2, like you said.
I know, Claire said. Sorry. But guess what? On top of everything else,
she paused. Waiting for what? A drum roll?
Pan has the chicken pox.
Siobhan laughed, though this, she realized, was cruel and may have been crossing the line.
The chicken pox.
She's very sick, Claire said, and contagious to boot, though my kids all had the vaccine, but she can't work. What am I going to do about a sitter?
Who's watching them now?
Jason. He should be at work, but he agreed to help. What am I going to do about the gala, though?
Nightmare. Nightmare? She wanted nightmare? Siobhan could redefine nightmare. Carter had spent 3 days surfing and skulking around the house like a derelict, doing little more than drinking beer and eating the junk Siobhan bought for the children. Go-gurts, barbecue-flavored Fritos, slushy pops. Then she caught him on a suspicious phone call on their landline. He'd claimed it was Jason, but the call log showed a number with an unfamiliar area code, and that did it. The camel was on its knees. Siobhan threw him out. She loved repeating the phrase, threw him out, though in reality what she had said was,
Please make yourself scarce, Carter Crispin. Go away, take a trip, leave the island for a few days, get out of my hair until this gala mess is behind me. Then we can start over. I can focus, we can talk, and we will work this out and find you some much-needed help, okay?
And Carter had said, okay. Siobhan gave him $300 from her secret till. On the one hand, she couldn't believe he hadn't offered to stay and help her with the gala. How in God's name would she pull it off alone? But on the other hand, she was glad he was respecting her. She had fired him. She was the boss. He would do exactly as she said. He packed a small bag. Siobhan watched him, both defiant and sad. She loved the man, yes, she did, but he was little more than rocks in her pocket right now. "Where will you go?" she asked him. He shrugged and did not meet her eye. "Probably the city." New York City, she thought at the time. It was only after he was gone that she understood he'd meant Atlantic City. With Carter gone, Siobhan had been forced to leave the boys at home alone. They were 9 and 7 and would be able to survive for weeks as long as they had potato chips, a working bathroom, and the TV remote. However, Siobhan felt guilty, guilty, guilty. It was a beautiful summer day, and her two healthy sons were sitting in their darkened bedroom, eating tooth-rotting, heart-stopping junk, and turning their brains to mush on reruns of The Sweet Life of Zack and Cody. She might have brought them with her to the kitchen, but in her past attempts to get them to help, to foster an appreciation of her work and perhaps spark an interest in learning to cook themselves, they had complained incessantly, eaten her mise en place, and played obnoxious practical jokes like making tea sandwiches out of their boogers. Siobhan could not jeopardize this job by bringing Liam and Aiden to the kitchen, and yet since she left them, she had done nothing but worry that they might choke on a pretzel rod or electrocute themselves or engage in a fight that left them both bleeding, that they might notice the beautiful day and venture out to the beach on their bicycles, which would lead either to their drowning in the ocean or to their getting hit by a car in the road. It was not safe to leave a 7- and a 9-year-old alone, but Siobhan did not have a live-in au pair, with chickenpox or otherwise. She was her own au pair. She was, for the next few days, a single parent, as well as the sole owner and operator of this catering business, which was attempting to pull off a seated dinner for 1,000 people. 600 lobsters to poach. Was she insane? Genevieve at A la Table would have bought the lobster meat frozen. To buy it fresh was prohibitively expensive. However, frozen lobster meat was watery and bland, and despite her diminished circumstances, Siobhan wouldn't compromise. Claire ripped the arms off the lobster with no small amount of gusto. "You know, this is cathartic. I need to let off a little aggression." She ripped the arms off another. 12 months ago, Claire would never have been able to rip the arms off a living creature, and now here she was, enjoying it. What did that say? Siobhan shook her head. "I was pretty shocked to find Edward here the other day," Claire said. "Is there something going on between you two that I should know about?"
"Something going on?" Siobhan said.
"Yeah. Are you two friends again?" Siobhan reached into the boiling cauldron with her 12-inch tongs, pulled out the steaming scarlet lobsters, and dropped them into a sink full of water to cool. She would literally be here all night shelling them, and that thought alone was enough to make her cry. She turned on Claire with all the fire she could muster.
"I'm not like you."
"What is that supposed to mean?"
"I am not a cheat like you. I am not a Madame Bovary in love with someone else."
"I only asked if you were friends," Claire said. "I didn't say anything about—"
"You insinuated."
"I did not. I just thought it was strange. You have to admit it was strange, you and Edward here alone."
"Adultery is a sin, Claire. It's evil. You want to know what I think? There it is. You are committing an evil sin against Jason and against your children and against yourself. You are betraying yourself. You are a good person, a person who remembers the mailman's birthday, a person who picks other people's rubbish up off the beach. And now, you're a different person. Look at you, dismembering the crustaceans."
"You asked me to. You said this was what you needed done."
"It's like all of a sudden you don't care about your soul," Siobhan said.
"My soul?"
You're going to tell me you love Locke Dixon. You're going to tell me Jason is emotionally unavailable and that the most intimate moments you have are when he reads to you from Penthouse Forum. It doesn't matter. You took a vow, my darling, to love him, forsaking all others. Remember that? I was standing there. You're breaking that vow every time you kiss Locke, every time you call him.
Siobhan was on a roll. She was pulling lobsters and dumping them as she spoke, and the steam was heating her up. The truth was bubbling out of her. Claire had lost her moral compass, or it was going haywire.
Either you stop this thing with Locke, or I'm telling Jason.
Claire stared at her.
What? I'm serious. End it, or I'll end it for you.
I can't believe you're saying this.
I mean it. I will tell Jason everything I know. I'll tell everybody.
You wouldn't do that.
I would so. Because I love you, Claire. And I can see how this is changing you and making you crazy and weak. It's ruining you. You have to put a stop to it.
Claire stared, shaking her head. Siobhan stared back for a defiant moment. She had not planned to lay down an ultimatum, but now that it was out, it felt right. Siobhan had had her chance to sleep with Edward, but she hadn't gone through with it, and she was glad. Her soul was clean, or sort of. There had been the kissing and the groping at Isabel's house, and then when Siobhan had agreed to take on the catering of the gala, Edward had called to thank her. He had called in his official capacity as head of the catering committee, but they had ended up talking for nearly an hour, and Siobhan told him about Carter's gambling. Edward made Siobhan promise that she would call him if she needed help, and Siobhan said, "Anytime you want to swing by the prep kitchen, I'll be there working by myself." He had come the very next day. He had held her hand and touched her cheek, and they had kissed again once, softly. And it might have gone further had Claire not come barging in. Siobhan had, in fact, called Edward that very morning on her way to the kitchen to tell him about Carter's exodus to AC and about leaving Liam and Aiden alone, and Edward had offered to cancel all of his appointments in order to take the kids out to Great Point in his Jeep. Siobhan had turned him down. The kids didn't know Edward, and news of any outing they took with Edward would make its way straight back to Carter. But it had felt good to have him offer. It was comforting to know that Edward would do anything for her. Anything. Because he loved her so. Siobhan was such a bloody hypocrite. But God, who wasn't? She was acting in bad faith with Edward, using him as a stanchion when her own husband was failing. She didn't love Edward, and implying that she might was disingenuous and would stop right now, this second. She would sell the engagement ring and give all the money, every penny, to charity. She was going to walk the path of virtue, and by way of her moral policing, she would make Claire walk it too. Someday, Claire would thank her. Besides, the ultimatum had been issued. She couldn't back out of it now. Anyone with children would know that. Locke was nearly ready to leave for the day when Ben Franklin walked into the office. It was 6:30, and the light through the 20-paned window was slanted and golden, which meant that summer was ending. Summer ending already? Well, yes. The summer gala was always the last thing on the social calendar, and the charity benefited from the sense of nostalgia people felt when their departure from the island was imminent. Heather would return to Andover on Monday. Locke couldn't stand to think about it. Because of the chaos surrounding the next few days, he and Daphne were taking Heather out to dinner to the galley tonight. Their reservation was in an hour. Locke was not exactly happy to see Ben Franklin walk through the door, but he had been meaning to connect with the man all week and for various reasons had missed him.
"Hello, Ben, hello," Locke said, standing up. "Good thing you caught me. I was just on my way out the door."
He reached across his desk for Ben's hand, but Ben's arms were loaded down with the financials.
"Can I help you with those?" Locke said.
Ben dropped them unceremoniously on Locke's desk, There is money missing, he said. A lot of money.
The house was clean, so the objective on Friday was to keep it that way.
We have a visitor coming, Claire told the kids.
A rock star, Jason said.
The day had the feeling of a holiday. Jason was staying home from work. He had been a real trooper since Pan got sick, but his good, accommodating mood seemed to be tied to the fact that the day of the gala was almost upon them, and hence almost past them. He was still X-ing out the squares on the calendar with his heavy-lined black Sharpie. 3 days until I get my wife back. 2 days. Once again, Claire had been awake all night. Siobhan was breaking every best friend rule in the book. She was going to blow the whistle on Claire. She was personally determined to save Claire's soul. This was so ludicrous that at first Claire hadn't known whether to believe her. But yes, she had to believe her.
I'm doing this for your own good.
Claire had to admit her relationship with Locke wasn't strong right now. They were too consumed with the gala, and Locke was busy courting his daughter. They had not connected. They had not been intimate.
But could she leave him? Could she go back to the person she had been before all this?
Claire Danner Crispin, mother of four, local artisan, generally good and moral person? Could she go back to Jason and Siobhan? Snap herself back into her rightful place? What would her life be like without Locke? She couldn't imagine anymore. The conclusion that Claire had come to while she was lying in bed was that she would tell Siobhan she had ended the affair, and then continue it secretly. She would be back to lying to everyone. Claire had thought the day before the gala would be busy, but she was wrong. Everything had been taken care of. The tent was up, the production team was hanging lights, setting up the audio, prepping the stage. The contract musicians were flying in that afternoon. Edward had an associate picking them up and delivering them to their hotel. Gavin had organized the table numbers, the seating chart, the who went where. The chandelier was safe and sound in the concession stand. Tomorrow, it would be unpacked and put on display. Claire had called Bruce Mandelay one final time to make sure Matthew was on his way.
His flight leaves in an hour, Bruce said. He'll be there at 7 o'clock, your time. You just have to make sure you get all of the alcohol out of your house.
Yes, Claire said, absolutely.
He went out to the bars for the first time in months the night before last. He found himself a fight and spent the night in jail. It hit the tabloids today.
Oh, no, Claire said.
He needs to get out of town, Bruce said. Nantucket will be good for him.
Claire took the beer and half a bottle of Viognier out of the fridge. She took the beer out of the fridge in the garage. She took the vodka out of the freezer. She took the gin, Mount Gay, Patron, Cuervo, Vermouth, Amaretto, and Grand Marnier out of the liquor cabinet, leaving only club soda, tonic, lime juice, and a sticky jar of maraschino cherries. She put all the alcohol in the super-secret storage place where they hid the kids' Christmas presents, and she locked the door. Matthew would be there in a matter of hours. Claire called the office. It was the day before the gala. Surely there were things to do.
Everything is under control, Gavin said.
Have you heard from Isabel? Claire said. I left a message with her Tuesday and again yesterday, and I sent an email, but I haven't heard back. I'm afraid she won't come to the gala.
She's coming to the gala, Gavin said.
He sounded pretty confident about that, and Claire relaxed a little.
So there is nothing for me to do? She said.
Nothing, he said.
Jason was taking the kids to the beach.
Sure you don't want to come? Jason said.
No, Claire said. I'd better stay here and wait.
Wait for what? Matthew wasn't due in until 7 that evening. Claire wiped down the countertops yet again. The house was clean, the guest room as immaculate and comfortable as the Four Seasons. Claire had stocked her kitchen with chocolate milk and Nilla wafers,
and the freezer was full of cherry Italian ice. Claire checked on Pan. Her fever was down to 100.7, and her spots were starting to itch, a good sign. She was sitting up in bed, reading Harry Potter. Claire brought her a fresh glass of ice water and a mug of Thai fire broth.
"I'm sorry I can't work," Pan said.
"Don't be sorry, we'll figure something out."
Claire left the room. She had calls out to 4 different babysitters, and she was now waiting to hear back. She would figure something out. Earlier in the week, Claire had bumped into Libby Jenkins, one of the gala co-chairs from last year, in town. Libby had asked, "How are you doing?" And Claire had said, "Great, we're right on track." Libby had said, "Don't worry, it's still early. Everything tends to fall apart at the last minute." She laughed. Claire had laughed along, thinking, "Clearly the woman has no interest in bolstering my self-confidence." As it was, things were held together with string and chewing gum. Matthew was coming off a bad drinking binge, the au pair had the chicken pox, Isabel wasn't speaking to her, and Claire was being blackmailed by her best friend. In typical fashion, Claire had succumbed to Siobhan. Rather than fight her, she had caved in. Rather than say, "No, I will not let you blackmail me," she had said, "Yes, I will let you blackmail me. I will end things with Locke." "Just let me get through the weekend," Claire said.
"Okay," Siobhan agreed.
They had parted amicably. They had kissed goodbye. No doubt, the place where Claire could be most helpful today was in the catering kitchen, helping Siobhan. But Claire did not want to work under Siobhan's judgmental eye. Claire would be chopping cilantro, and Siobhan would be thinking, "Sinner, cheater, lying Madame Bovary, aren't you worried about your soul?" Claire checked her email. Nothing. Isabel had not turned up. Claire checked her outfit. She had finally found the perfect dress at Gypsy. It was a Colette Dinigan of green and gold lace. It was form-fitting but flirty and feminine. Silky, lacy, sexy. Claire checked her high heels and the jewelry she planned to wear. She confirmed her hair appointment at the salon. In the morning, 40 women were gathering to decorate. Tablecloths, flower arrangements, candles, tasteful and discreet balloons. Locke would make a speech, then give a short PowerPoint presentation. Adams would do the thank yous. Pietro da Silva would auction the chandelier. Matthew would perform. Claire sunk into the sofa. There was nothing to do but wait. Wait for things to go wrong. He had played for Queen Elizabeth, Princess Diana, Nelson Mandela, Jacques Chirac, Julia Roberts, Robert De Niro, Jack Nicholson, the Sultan of Brunei, the Dalai Lama. He had played Bill Clinton's second inauguration and Super Bowl 28. He had played at both the Oscars and the Grammys. He had played Shea, Fenway, Madison Square Garden, Minute Maid Park, the LA Forum, Soldier Field, the Meadowlands. He had sung with Buffett, Tom Petty, Dylan, Clapton, Ray Charles, Jerry Lee Lewis, Harry Connick Jr., Harry Belafonte, and The Boss. He had recorded soundtracks for 16 major motion pictures, 2 HBO series, and 5 commercials, including ones for Coca-Cola and Radio Shack. And Max West, a.k.a. Matthew Westfield, thought he had never been so nervous as when he arrived on Nantucket to see Claire Danner again. Well, maybe once. On the dark school bus, in December 1986, the bus that was taking the chorus from the elderly folks' home in Cape May back to their high school in Wildwood. Matthew and Claire were juniors. They had been best friends since they were 12. He had slept next to her, platonically, in bed. He had seen her pee. He had seen her puke beer out her nose. She had broken up with Timmy Carlsbad, and he had listened to her cry for 3 weeks. He had broken up with Yvonne Simpson, and Claire had fallen down the stairs on her way to get the phone at 2 a.m. when he called to tell her. On that night, on the school bus, Matthew was feeling good. He had performed 3 numbers with the barbershop quartet, and the old people's eyes had lit up. They had smiled. They had clapped and called out, "Bravo! Encore!" It was his first taste of being a star, and he was high from it. He thought, "I never want this feeling to end." He had brought those people, whose lives were nearing their dismal end, happiness just by singing. So let's say it was all timing. Claire laid her head on his shoulder, put her hand on his leg, and said, "You were great. I'm proud of you." He had immediately gotten an erection, which was at 16 not an uncommon thing. He had in fact masturbated while thinking of Claire more than once, though he never would have admitted it to her or anyone else. She was his closest friend, close enough to be his sister. He shouldn't feel this way about her, but he did. His dick was a shaft of glowing steel. Her head on his shoulder and her hand on his leg were bright, burning spots. His heartbeat was an amplified bass line. Surely she could feel it. Should he kiss her? He wanted to kiss her. But either she would become angry, which he didn't want, or she would laugh, which he couldn't bear. He sat through 1, 2, 3 agonizing moments. Was he brave enough? He was 16, but he had the wisdom somehow to know that another moment like this wasn't likely to come along anytime soon. The dark bus. Him a star. He lifted her head. He kissed her. It remained the singular kiss of his life. Romantic nonsense? This was the question Matthew had asked himself over and over again since October, when he had learned he would be seeing Claire again. Was it all just romantic nonsense, a fixation from his youth? Would she even be recognizable to him as the same person when he saw her? Would she still have any of the qualities that he treasured and had kept in his heart all these years? Had she aged? Had she changed? This was the kind of nervousness he supposed people felt when they attended high school reunions, which he never did, for obvious reasons. Jesus. The anticipation was killing him. His pervasive thought, of course, was that he needed a drink. And he did keep alcohol on the plane for emergencies such as this one, but he had had it all removed specifically for this flight because he knew himself. He knew he would want a drink, but he didn't want to have been drinking when he saw Claire. He had nearly derailed 2 days earlier. He had gone out with Archie Cole, the drummer from Sugar Shack, who was so young and clueless he didn't realize Max was an alcoholic. They got completely hammered on gin and tequila, and Archie picked a fight with a complete bozo at one of the clubs, and Max, in an attempt to help Archie out, got socked in the eye and ended up in the slammer. It was typical idiot stuff. He had to stop. The plane landed, but they were delayed on the runway. Matthew whipped out his cell phone and sent her a text message. "Just landed. I'm nervous." A second later, his phone beeped. The message from Claire said, "Don't be nervous. I'm here alone." There was a special part of the airport for private planes. Matthew sat, searching out the window, fidgeting. "Let me off. Where was she?" She was there somewhere. Finally, they opened the hatch and let the stairs down, and the pilot said, "Welcome to Nantucket Island." And Terry and Alfonso, who had been asleep, woke up and descended before him. Sometimes when Max West's plane landed, the press or a private citizen got wind of it, and there was a crowd of fans waiting, screaming, and waving signs, and it never failed to make Matthew feel like one of the Beatles. But this time, tonight, when he descended, there was only one person waiting. She had gotten security clearance because she was standing there at the bottom of the stairs, alone, as promised. Matthew looked at her, and his mind went blank. She smiled at him, grinned really, like a 17-year-old girl, and wrung her hands. What did he think? He couldn't think. He was gazing upon something beautiful that he had lost, but that now, amazingly, was found. Claire. She was herself. The red hair, the thin white wrists, the green eyes. She reached out for him, and he hugged her, and his eyes filled with tears. They did not speak. He lifted her up off the ground. She was as light as a feather. It was miraculous as if she'd been dead all these years, but had somehow been brought back to life. His Claire. In the car, she talked and he gawked. He sat in the front seat of her SUV, which smelled like rug shampoo. Terry and Alfonso were in the back. Alfonso was smoking, finally, gratefully, after Claire had assured him it was okay, and he was careful to blow the smoke out the window. Matthew held Claire's hand. He couldn't help himself, because his primary emotion was fear that she would vanish. He had last seen her, Jesus, 12 years earlier, at a concert at Boston Garden. She had come backstage with Jason, who was at that time her fiancé. Matthew had been married to Stacy then, though he was drinking heavily and their marriage was on the rocks. Stacy had been jealous of Claire, and their meeting backstage was chaotic and awkward. Matthew had been drunk or high. He had paid too much attention to Jason, trying to impress or intimidate him, and not enough attention to Claire, though Stacy accused him otherwise. Then Claire disappeared into the crowd, and Matthew was too high to feel the loss of her. He felt it months later, his first time at Hazelden. He would not lose her again. She was whole and perfect, an artifact unearthed. She did not know it as she chimed along about the gala, but he had no intention of letting her go. She dropped Terry and Alfonso off at their hotel, and then they were alone. She thanked him yet again for coming to play, and he said,
"I would do anything for you, Claire Danner, and you know it."
At a stop sign, she reached across the car and touched his face. "What happened here?" He had a dark purple crescent beneath his eye and some yellowing on his swollen upper cheek where he'd taken that punch.
"I was out of line," he said. "Got what I deserved."
"You were drinking?" Claire asked.
"Drinking and stupid," Matthew said.
What he needed was someone to keep him on the straight and narrow. Someone like Claire.
"It won't happen while I'm here, I promise."
"Okay," she said. They pulled into her driveway. The house was large and lovely, lit from within. He had pictured Claire in just such a house, happy and bright. She deserved it.
"Here already?" he said.
He should have asked her to drive around some, show him the island, even though it was nearly dark. He didn't want to go inside and face the husband and the kids. He wanted Claire to himself. "Here already," she said. Max West was a rock star, but since Bess and the dogs had left, he had gotten used to being alone. Claire lived in a house full of people, her husband, a slew of kids, so many people.
"Matthew, this is Jason," Claire said. "You remember my husband, Jason Crispin?"
Matthew did not remember Jason. He could not have picked Jason out of a crowd of two. They had met so long ago, and Max had been wasted, and nothing about Jason was remarkable. He was a big guy, well, bigger than Matthew, and rock solid with muscles. He was tan, he had blonde hair, and there was a day's growth on his face. He was a handsome enough guy, Matthew supposed, but was he special enough for Claire? Max didn't think so. Could Max take him in a fight? That remained to be seen.
"Hey, man, how you doing?" Jason said.
He had an aggressive handshake and that eager glint in his eye that everyone got when they met Max West.
"Good to see you again. I am a huge fan."
Matthew smiled. So underwhelming. Not special enough for Claire. Not even close. The most interesting thing about Jason was that he was drinking something from a blue plastic stadium cup. Was it beer? And if it was, Would underwhelming Jason offer Matthew one? Because being in Claire's actual house and meeting her actual family was making him anxious, and when he got anxious, he got thirsty. He needed a drink. Underwhelming Jason noticed Matthew's gaze. He tipped his cup and said, "Iced tea, can I get you one?"
"Iced tea?"
Matthew nearly groaned. Bruce had called.
"No thanks, man," Matthew said. "I'm all set."
Meanwhile, Claire had the children lined up like Russian dolls, ready to meet him, and she was running through the names. Jaden, Odyssey, or did she say Honesty? He missed the third one's name completely, but caught that the baby's name was Zach. The kids were beautiful, gorgeous, with their golden red hair, their summer tans, their gap-toothed smiles. These were his kids.
"It's nice to meet you," Matthew said to his kids. "I brought presents."
He unzipped his duffel and pulled out the black Louis Vuitton shopping bag that his assistant Ashland had handed him on the tarmac at LAX. He'd sent her, at the last minute, to Rodeo Drive to get the kids' gifts.
"They're little kids," he'd said. "Or maybe some of them are grown. Two boys, two girls, get a range."
The kids ravaged the packages as if it was Christmas morning. He, Matthew, was Santa Claus. Claire and Jason looked on politely. Claire said, "You didn't have to bring them anything, Matthew. They have everything under the sun."
"But we don't have one of these," the oldest boy, what was his name, shouted.
He held up a silver Colibri lighter.
"What is that?" Claire said. "Let me look at it."
She flipped it open.
Flame. "It's a lighter."
Matthew filled with dread. There was a typical rock star move. Buy a 10-year-old boy a $100 Italian lighter so he can take up smoking weed in the basement with style.
"Mom, give it back," the kid said. "I want it."
"You're going to burn the house down," Claire said. She was laughing, sort of. It was strained. Matthew could not look at Jason. The worst thing was that now Matthew would have to fire Ashland. A lighter? What had she been thinking?
"What else is there?" Matthew asked nervously.
"A bong? A handgun?" There were two Louis Vuitton silk scarves for the girls, as well as some Chanel eyeshadow in the blue palette. Claire looked like she was going to pop a vein. She would never run off with him now. In the box for the baby, Zach, was a remote control Ferrari Testarossa. That was a hit with everyone except the baby. Jason especially seemed enthralled. Max exhaled, relaxed a little bit. Okay, Ashland could keep her job.
"Can I get you something to drink?" Claire said. "We have iced tea, water, milk, chocolate milk, juice, OJ pomegranate and apple cranberry, or I could make coffee, espresso, cappuccino, regular, decaf."
Matthew was dying to ask for a beer, just one cold beer. The situation was unusually stressful, so he deserved one beer. He wouldn't get drunk. He was a gin man. Beer for him was like juice. But he couldn't bring himself to ask. Claire would be disappointed in him, and she would know how weak he really was, unable to last 10 minutes without a drink. He opted for coffee, and Claire made a pot. The evening wore on. Matthew wanted to be with Claire and Claire alone. It was Claire, after all, that he'd come to see. But Claire's house was a circus. It was the boardwalk on an August night. It was an obstacle course. Matthew was introduced to the nanny, a Thai girl named Pan, who had the chicken pox. She stood across the room bowing to him, and he thought of Ace in Bangkok. In the end, he had given her $5,000 to help her pay for college.
"Sawadee kop," Matthew said.
He could say hello in 40 languages. Did Claire know this? Pan giggled and ducked back into her room. Matthew would much rather have talked to Pan, but underwhelming Jason was right there at his side, dogging him.
"That's right, man. You toured in Asia. What was that like, man?"
What was it like? Matthew could talk about this all day. He had played for people with totally different belief systems. Buddhists, Muslims, Hindus. But underwhelming Jason, like every other American man, wanted to talk about the girls, the perks, the money. Matthew needed a drink. He needed some quiet time alone with Claire. He found it hard to believe that mankind had created the iPod, a 10-ounce slab of plastic that could play 20,000 songs, but had been unable to invent a way to travel back in time 20 years, to the happiest days of your life, and allow you to stay there. Claire. She fussed over him, put out a bowl of Nilla wafers, his favorite, and brought him a bag of frozen peas for his eye. It grew later, and finally she excused herself to put the kids to bed. "It's so good to see you," she said before she went upstairs. "I'm really glad you're here."
"But you're coming back downstairs, right?"
he said. Desire had thickened his voice. He sounded to his own ears like he was tipping his hand. Jason grew silent and looked at Claire.
"Yes," Claire said. "I'll be back down to say goodnight."
He was nuts, he thought, believing that he might have some time alone with Claire when her husband was in the house. It would be smarter to wait until the morning, when underwhelming Jason went to work. However, much to Matthew's delight, Jason retired first. He was an early riser, he said, by way of apologizing, it seemed. Matthew shook Jason's hand, giddy to see him go. The feeling of being in a time warp intensified. How many late nights had Matthew and Claire sat up watching a movie, waiting for Sweet Jane to go to bed so they could fool around? Left alone to his own devices, Matthew hunted through the fridge for a beer. Nothing. There was a bar in the living room, a beautiful built-in bar with rows of sparkling glasses, but the cabinets were empty of everything but mixers and garnishes. Claire had done her homework. It was an act of love, he knew, a demonstration that she cared about his well-being, but it was maddening. He wouldn't survive another minute without a drink, so he sneaked quickly to the fridge in the garage. Empty. He returned to the living room, defeated and shaking from too much caffeine. The Thai au pair appeared in her nightgown. He noticed her necklace, a tiny silver bell, and he reached out to touch it.
"That's pretty," he said.
"Thank you," she said.
She was covered with plump red spots.
"I get you anything?"
"I need a drink," he thought.
He could enlist the au pair to help him. But Claire would know, she would find out, and she would be so disappointed. Or maybe, like Bess, she operated on zero tolerance and she would ask him to leave.
"I'm all set," he said. "Thanks."
Pan bowed, and Matthew repaired to the back deck. The tender, bruised skin around his eye throbbed with pain. He was a rock star, and the world was his oyster. He could have anything he wanted. But could he have Claire? He was as spoiled as a child. Bess had said this time and again. He was used to instant gratification. "The best things in life," she'd said, "are the things you have to wait for." Well, he had waited 20 years for Claire. He could wait 10 more minutes, couldn't he? Was she feeling the same way he was? Would she leave with him? He wanted to know now. Tomorrow, he thought, he would have a drink. He was here, in her house. She still had a hard time believing it. The second coming of Matthew. He was waiting for her on the back deck, his elbows resting behind him on the railing, his legs angled forward. He was in jeans and bare feet, watching for her. She grinned. He was here. It was him.
"God," he said, "you are still so beautiful."
That voice, it had always been his voice more than his looks that had captivated her. He put an arm around her and she leaned into him. It was friendly and comfortable. They were sliding back into their old identities, their teenage selves.
It is so great to see you.
I know, she said. Honestly, it's like we were never apart. He gave her a squeeze. They didn't say anything else for a while, though there were things she might have asked him. Things she wanted to know about Bess, about his drinking problem, about his famous affair with Savannah Bright. But it was better somehow to pretend for a minute that none of that had ever happened. She wanted to forget Locke and Jason and the kids inside and just try to locate her old self. She wanted to be that girl on the boardwalk, in the dunes eating lobster, jumping into the passenger side of the yellow bug. She wanted to rest in Matthew's arms and pretend for 5 minutes. He smelled the same. Was that possible? He had, as a teenager, smelled like whatever brand of discount laundry detergent Sweet Jane favored, and secondhand smoke from his older sister's cigarettes, and that was how he still smelled. She looked up at his face, a face she had most frequently seen in the past 12 years on the screen of VH1. He started humming in her ear, and then the humming turned into singing. He was very softly singing Stormy Eyes in her ear, a private concert for Claire. He had written the song for her the week before they parted ways. Stormy Eyes became his first hit. He held her face. She was crying now. Of course she was crying. He couldn't sing that song to her and not expect her to cry. And then he kissed her. He kissed her slowly, carefully, and she thought of Matthew on the dark bus, a sudden surprise superstar. Sweet Rosie O'Grady. Matthew with his guitar slung across his back. Matthew, the night they played strip poker and he got so, so jealous. That girl of mine makes me crazy. Matthew standing beside the examining table. Claire was pregnant, she knew it. Matthew was going to have to sell the peel, and she was going straight to hell. Anemia. Matthew on stage at the Pony, Claire standing behind him, banging the tambourine against her hip like Tracy Partridge. He was already gone from her, she could see it, even before Bruce introduced himself, before they drove to New York in Bruce's Pinto, and Bruce bought Claire a cheeseburger and Coke at a turnpike rest stop. She could have held on tighter, she knew that, but she let him go, and look what happened. He became a star. And as a star, he'd come back to her. Here he was. Could all these thoughts be contained in a single kiss? It seemed impossible. But yes. He pulled away.
I love you, Claire. I want you to come with me when I leave.
She was confused. And do what? She said.
Live with me. Marry me.
Matthew, she said. The idea struck her as funny, and then it struck her as sad. He was so lost, and she was lost too. More lost than he knew.
Will you? He said.
Oh, she said. Oh, oh, oh. Dear, darling grace of God, he was asking her for real. He meant it. I wish I could. Believe me when I say, a part of me wishes I could.
Your kids can come with us. We'll get a tutor. Lots of people do it on the road. It will be good for them to see other countries, to learn other languages, experience other cultures.
Matthew, she said, I have a life here.
You'll have a life with me. Please. I need you.
You need someone, but that someone isn't me.
It is you. You're telling me you don't feel it?
She felt something. What was it? Vestiges of old heartache. Intense nostalgia. Delight at seeing him, at touching him, at hearing him tell her she was still beautiful. A part of her wanted to run away with him. A part of her wanted to escape the turmoil she'd created. Just leave. Run off.
Go on tour. Take the kids or leave them behind. Get out of there. She had a lot of feelings, but she did not mistake any of them for love. She kissed him on the tip of his nose. He still had the scar. Measles, age 7. She hadn't seen him in forever, but she knew him so well. She knew what was best for him. He had not wanted to go to California to record the album. He didn't want to leave her. She said, "If you don't go now, you'll miss your big chance." They fought about it. She insisted, "You have to go." He couldn't figure out why she was pushing him away. Things should have been the other way around. He should be wanting to go. She should be begging him to stay. Things were backward. He went. He wrote Stormy Eyes. He became a rock icon. He may have forgotten all this. She would remind him in the morning. She laid her head against his chest. In there, his heart was rattling. "Everything is going to be okay," she said. Someone had told her this recently, but who was it? Matthew relaxed. He may have believed her. Chapter 12. She knocks it down. She woke up with a burst of adrenaline, as if someone next to her had rung the bell. This was it. Post time. Jason had gone to the Downy Flake. He would have breakfast, check on things at the worksite, and be back by 10 so that Claire could head to the tent to decorate. He'd left a note on the counter. "Look outside." She looked. There was a crowd of people on the cul-de-sac in front of their house. What were they doing there?
"Autographs,"
a voice said behind her. Claire turned. Matthew peered over her shoulder out the window.
"They're here for me."
"They are?" Claire said. "Really?" This she had not predicted. That people would know Matthew was staying here. That they would come here, camp out with their cell phones and their iPods, hoping to see him, touch him, talk to him.
"Really?" Matthew said.
"It happens everywhere you go?"
"Everywhere."
"Your eye looks better."
"Does it?"
"No," she said. He smiled, but she knew he was hurting. The problem, she decided, was that they had never had proper closure. Their relationship was a campfire that had smoldered for years. It had not been doused. Matthew was lonely without Bess. He was a hostage to his alcohol addiction, and he was grabbing for Claire because she was stable, or so he believed. But they couldn't go back to Wildwood Crest in 1987, no matter how much either of them wanted to. "What would you like for breakfast?"
"A Bloody Mary."
"Matthew."
"I'm kidding."
"You promised me you'd be sober for tonight."
"I'm kidding."
Claire grabbed his arm. Upstairs, she heard Zach crying. "I would make you miserable."
"I don't believe that," he said.
She touched his cheek carefully, below his black eye.
"I love you, Claire,"
he said. And she said, "I know." She was a get-it-done machine. She had yet to nail down a babysitter, but as she was flipping a tower of pancakes for Matthew and the kids, it dawned on her. She stepped outside. The gawkers were gathered on the cul-de-sac like a Greek chorus. Claire approached three teenage girls and asked if any of them could babysit that night. All three had planned to crash the gala to hear Max West sing, but one, the oldest, most together-looking one, Hannah, her name was, agreed to babysit if she could get her picture taken with Max West. "Done," Claire said. "We'll need you at 5. She was the Energizer Bunny. She was stage manager, den mother, multitasking superwoman. She tied 500 silver balloons to the backs of chairs. She centered flower arrangements and smoothed tablecloths. She reviewed the timetable with Gavin. She inspected the green room. No alcohol in there, right?
Right.
She folded programs, she called Jason 12 times, she had a birthday party from 1 to 3, the present was wrapped, he just had to drop her off and pick her up and Zach could sleep in the car. J.D. was going to the Fisk's house. Ottilie was not allowed to wear the eyeshadow Matthew had brought, no matter how convincingly she made her case. No TV for the kids today, and no cigarettes for Jason. I'm going to need you to be charming tonight. Talk to people, make conversation, even though you hate it, okay, Jace?
Okay, boss, he said.
Claire avoided the prep kitchen. Siobhan would put her to work, and although she didn't have time to punch out 500 rounds of brioche with a biscuit cutter, she would be too cowardly to turn Siobhan down. Claire did not see Locke, nor did she see Isabel. When she drove back to the house to pick up Matthew, she found him commingling with the gawkers on the cul-de-sac. Had any of them given him alcohol or weed? She was suspicious, but she didn't have time to investigate.
We have to go, she said.
In the car, Matthew said,
Are you breathing?
Claire said, If we don't haul ass, we're going to be late. He said,
I don't think I've ever seen you like this.
They picked up Terry and Alfonso and drove back to the tent for the sound check. This time, Claire did look for Locke, and she did look for Isabel. No luck, and she felt a flash of self-righteous indignation. Where were they? Why weren't they helping, the executive director and the event co-chair? Claire checked the green room again while Matthew was on stage. No alcohol in here, right?
Right.
Claire went to her hair appointment. She had her head tipped back in the sink and hot water rushing over her scalp when the stylist said,
You seem kind of tense.
Right, Claire thought. Could she even begin to explain? Today was the day. Tonight, the night. It was the culmination of a year's work. So much had happened. So much had changed. She had changed. She had spent hundreds of hours and thousands of dollars, thousands of hours and tens of thousands of dollars. She had experienced all of the stress and heartache promised to her at the beginning, and then some. And in 8 hours, it would be over. Claire would be in bed. The thought should have been the source of enormous joy and relief, but instead, Claire felt depressed. All that anticipation and build-up and preparation, and like everything else, it would end. They would be left with what? A pile of money. Hope and happiness for kids who needed it. That was the whole point. Gavin arrived at Isabel's house at 5 o'clock. They had time for one drink, and then they had to go. Gavin had myriad responsibilities at the tent. The gala would not come off properly without him there directing. He should skip the drink and proceed post-haste to the tent, but Isabel had been adamant. Come at 5. We'll have time for one drink. And Gavin found her impossible to deny. She was sitting on the bench by the koi pond in the foyer when he arrived. He didn't have to knock. The front door was wide open, and she was waiting for him, dressed in a stunning red valentine of a gown, with her hair like a waterfall over her shoulders. She raised her face when he walked in, and he could tell she'd been crying. Are you okay? He said. She all but collapsed in his arms. Hopes for a light, breezy, and quick drink went down the drain. I just got off the phone with my ex-husband, she said. He didn't have time for this. He had to get to the tent. There were 50 volunteers currently donning black t-shirts and eating a staff meal of hot dogs and macaroni salad, donated by the Stop and Shop, waiting for him to give them their orders. Gavin knew nothing about the business of ex-husbands, or of emotional intimacy in general. Call him self-absorbed. That was probably true, but no one else's problems had ever captured his full attention. But in this case, his reticence was founded. He had to get to the tent, run the gala. Isabel was the co-chair. She should know this. Is everything okay? He said. He called, ostensibly to wish me good luck tonight, she said. But every time we talk, we get sucked down into the same old emotional quagmire.
Gavin was holding her tentatively. She was warm in his arms, and she smelled like powdered sugar.
I made such a fool of myself last fall, she said. There was another man. I was in love with him. He said he was in love with me. In fact, he said he was in love with me first, and that was why I fell in love with him. But he was a compulsive liar. He couldn't leave his wife. Never had any intention of doing so, despite frequent promises to the contrary. And then he claimed that he was staying with her for financial reasons, that he loved me, but he couldn't let her put him through the ringer. And he had kids. A retarded daughter in a home, and two boys at collegiate. He didn't want to lose them. She stopped. Can I get you a drink? Gavin said. Sure. He took a deep breath. The koi pond made bubbly noises at his feet, and he watched the fish darting through the water. It might have been better if he'd been born a fish. The world of human beings, of relating to them in a meaningful way, bewildered him. Locke and Claire, Edward and Siobhan, the guys who'd led him astray at Cap and Lehigh, poor Diana Prell in the broom closet, even his own parents, he had never understood them. He didn't know how firmly or gently to hold Isabel. She had thrust herself upon him, but he'd been holding her now for a few minutes. Should he let her go or pull her closer? But we should probably leave soon. She raised her face to him. Would you kiss me?
It was official. He was flustered. How many times had he chastised himself for not kissing Isabel on the night of the invitation stuffing, when they were alone, standing close together, under the intoxicating spell of the moon garden? That had been a painful moment of cowardice on his part, a missed opportunity. But this was different. The sunlight was intense, and Gavin's every muscle and tendon was alert to the pressing need to get going. He was always on time, his father's fault. To be early is to be on time, to be on time is to be late is to be forgotten. There was no time for kissing, and yet Isabel was poised, eyes fluttering closed, face raised, lips parted ever so slightly. Gavin was a man. He did not need to be asked twice. He kissed her. The kiss was soft and sweet. She was a cookie, a confection. He had in the past been too aggressive with women, but that was perhaps because other women had not been as delicious as Isabel. She smiled at him.
Thank you, she said.
She laid her head against his chest. He touched the shining curtain of her hair.
I'm looking forward to tonight.
Yes, he said. Me too. Gavin was the man.